is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Raggio and Tom Jossen, the senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, who keep the Long War Journal with their colleagues. The story of the vast canvas of the Ummah and the jihadists these many decades, three decades now, moving into the fourth. Right now, the focus is on Afghanistan. The headlines are stark and promising catastrophe ahead. From London, Taliban will kill us, warn over 100 former Afghan staff refuse UK asylum. Former employees call on UK government to reconsider as the security situation worsens day by day. From Reuters, the provincial capital of Sirte. From other reporting, we have so many different provinces that I'm going to count on Bill and Tom to sort this out. What appears to be the case in the global headlines is that the Afghan National Army is either consolidating or retreating, depending upon your point of view. I mention also that at this point, there is no change in the status of the so-called peace talks between the Taliban and the Kabul government. That is, there are no talks, to my knowledge. Gentlemen, a very good day to you. Rather than tumble down the headlines, I go immediately to the map that you have kept these many years. I believe 2014 is a starting date for us. And what you see on the map with all of these different capitals said to have fallen, or the provinces said to have fallen. For example, the Afghan provincial capital of Kunduz, Saripol, and Talakan. For example, the provincial capital taken over these last days of Shibirgan, the capital of the northern province of Jazjan. I'm not going to mangle the pronunciation anymore, Bill. I'm going to come to you when what your map tells us. Good day to you.
Good day, John. And yeah, I'll be the one to mangle the names if that's okay. Yeah, so over the weekend, since beginning of Friday, so Afghanistan has 34 provinces. Again, think of them as states here in the United States. And the Taliban have taken control of six provinces. These are the provincial capitals or cities. Some of them are small, but in the case of Kunduz, that's one of the larger Afghan cities. It's also a strategic city in the north. The first capital to fall is a capital called Zaranj. It's in Nimruz province in the southwest. And the Taliban now control the border crossing and all of the revenue that flows through that. The governor there, he was also the local warlord. He and his people just picked up and fled. From what I'm told, they were not promised air support in order to fend off the Taliban. So they made the calculation to leave. They just picked up. They took everything that wasn't bolted down and fled and started moving into Iran, into Pakistan. The next day, the Taliban took control of Shibirgan in Jazjan province. This is where Dostum, the powerful, formerly powerful Afghan warlord who slaughtered thousands of Taliban and, over the years, and, you know, he's from, this is what was his home city. That the Jazjan province is basically fully under Taliban control, as is Nimruz now. That's up in the north. And then on Saturday, the Taliban took control of Kunduz. That's a major strategic city. Saripol, the province of the same name. And then Takar, which the capital of is Talakan. That's a key city. That's where it's a very Tajik heavy, area. And that the Takar province is fully under Taliban control. The government, there are only three districts there contested. The rest are Taliban controlled. I got that out of the way. What does that tell us? The Taliban now controls a band of provinces that sweep from the north that sweep from west, east to west. And then with Zaranj under and Nimruz under Taliban control, the Taliban have effectively cut off Herat, city. One of the largest cities in Afghanistan, where the Taliban are battling security forces who are being organized by Ismail Khan. He seems to be one of the only effective leaders in Afghanistan that I can detect at the moment. Ishmael Khan, he's a warlord. He's the main man in Herat province, and he's been able to organize security forces basically not to defeat the Taliban, but they're trying to keep the Taliban from overrunning the city itself. That's what this has all sort of come to. Every morning, John, I wake up and I say, well, what province fell under Taliban, provincial capital fell under Taliban control? So that's the status. The Taliban's on the offensive. They have the initiative. They're winning this war right now. The Afghan government is clinging control to cities like Kandahar and Lashkargah and Helmand, where they're just basically throwing security forces into the maw to prevent the Taliban from overrunning a couple of neighborhoods in each city. It's insanity. I understand the Afghan government doesn't want to give up and give the impression that it's losing, but everyone knows that it's losing right now. And as we've been saying, Tom and I've been saying from the beginning, they need to consolidate, defend what they can defend. They're trying to defend everything, and in effect, they're defending nothing.
Tom, I come to you because one of the methods in the 20th century to take a country was to invest the capital and then get a hold of the radio station. That was the 20th century. Here in the 21st century, it's not only radio or audio, it's video as well. And you tell us of an assassination that looks to be along that model. The man's name was Dawa Khan Manapul. What happened, Tom? Who is he and what happened?
Well, John, he was the director of the Afghan government's media and information center. So he was one of the chief officials responsible on behalf of Kabul for fighting the information war against the Taliban. He was active on social media and he was trying to basically counter Taliban messaging. This assassination that occurred in Kabul is an example of how over the last week, the Taliban has now begun a targeted assassination campaign against senior Afghan officials, not just military officials. They tried to kill the acting defense minister last week and just barely failed in that regard. But this assassination was successful. They gunned him down in a car where he was traveling from a mosque in Kabul. So they're going to keep, the Taliban is going to keep doing this. They're going to keep going after senior Afghan officials in Kabul. So as they're taking that territory that Bill is talking about, it's what I call the inside out sort of strategy for the insurgency. They're taking territory where they can on the outside, the periphery of Kabul, while launching targeted attacks inside Kabul now. And I expect that that's going to ramp up over the coming weeks. You're going to see probably not just more targeted assassinations, but perhaps even bigger attacks. And this all goes to the fact, John, that there is no peace process. You know, it's something we belabored this point many times on your show in the past, but I think it's worth reiterating that the U.S. and its allies have been invested in a fantasy for years now that there is some sort of peace process between the Taliban and Kabul. That fantasy really benefited the Taliban in many ways. It did nothing to help Kabul and to help America's allies. And as you can see right now in Afghanistan, as the red areas in the map grow and grow and the Taliban gets stronger and stronger, you can see that this was all sort of nonsense from the beginning.
Two details, Tom. The assassination of the spokesperson, was this a suicide unit? A martyrdom unit, and was the attack on the defense minister a martyrdom unit?
So the attack on the defense minister used a martyrdom unit or suicide unit. It was sort of there's this tactic that the jihadis use, which is called ingmasi attacks, and it basically comes from the Arabic word for immersion. And what it is the attack on the defense minister was at his home in Kabul, and they used a car bomb to basically clear the path for a number of gunmen. And so the car bomb goes in and makes a big scene, a big explosion, killing people. And then that paves the way for the gunmen to go in and try and kill their target. And those gunmen are willing to fight to the death. That was the attack on the defense minister, which failed. The attack on the government information and media center director, that was actually just a targeted assassination using gunmen alone on a car that was traveling through Kabul.
The reason I asked Tom is that this indicates that Taliban has successfully penetrated the capital at will. Is that a fair conclusion from what we're looking at? The city is overrun with agents.
Oh, there's no doubt that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have a sophisticated facilitation network inside Kabul. They really dialed that back in recent months. They've been planning, in my view, they've been planning to conduct bigger attacks, more targeted operations, and now we're just beginning to see that. So this is something where, you know, I think in the past, the Haqqani Network, which is an integral part of the Taliban and closely allied with Al-Qaeda, has carried out some of the biggest operations in Kabul. They're certainly capable of doing more along those lines. But now you're seeing that these martyrdom units and others that are being dispatched are doing these targeted assassinations. I expect you're going to see some bigger bombings, that sort of thing, in the weeks to come.
Bill, about your map, which is clearly indicating a stranglehold around Kabul. Stranglehold. This is siege tactics. Do you have reports of the roads being cut throughout the country? Are the roads cut to Pakistan? Is there an attempt by the Taliban to isolate Kabul?
Yeah, John, that's a fantastic question. And the answer is yes. We're seeing with the Taliban controlling the border crossings, they control Spin Baldock, which is in Kandahar, that controls into the access into Balochistan. It's a major crossing. Not only they control the traffic, but they are taking revenue again. That's probably $1 billion a year flows through that single border crossing and elsewhere. Taliban, where they control the cities, they clearly control the roads, and many major districts. So just to be clear, sometimes, even though these roads are often Taliban controlled, it's probably more better to describe them as contested. Occasionally the Afghan military will run convoys up and down these roads. They'll come in under fire. Essentially the Taliban controls these roads by taxing them. Everyone knows, you know, whether a road's dangerous to travel on, what the Taliban are doing. But particularly into Kabul, the Taliban, what I'm seeing is they're highly contesting that road from Jalalabad that goes across the Torkom border crossing into that flows from Kabul to Jalalabad in Nangarhar province and then the Torkom border crossing with Pakistan. I'm seeing a lot of activity there. If the Taliban are able to strangle that road, make it really difficult for Afghan forces to travel on that road, then what you have at that point is Kabul effectively cut off via the ground. And then the only real way that the city could be resupplied would be via air. And as we know, the Afghan Air Force, their assets are beginning to they're decreasing by the day. They're losing helicopters and they're burning through maintenance on all of their airframes. So the control of the roads is really important. It's something the Taliban understands, and it's something the Taliban is making every effort to gain the advantage. And that road to Kabul, Jalalabad, Torkom Highway, that has to stay open. I don't have a lot of confidence in the Afghan security forces that they can do it.
I'm speaking with Bill Rajo and Tom Jossen. They are senior fellows, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. To follow the story, the Long War Journal, with the map and the explication of the capitals as they fall. Also, the tragedy of the Afghan people with no way out. Siege tactics are to destroy everyone inside the city. Kabul right now is in the millions. I can't give you a count because the refugee flow has started. We're going to turn to the neighborhood next because the capitals surrounding Afghanistan see the collapse and know that the Taliban is enraged and on the march. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS Eye in the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rajo and Tom Jossen, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's senior fellows. They keep the Long War Journal. This is how to follow the tragedy underway in Afghanistan and the neighborhood. Tom, I come to you to read from the AP report in these last hours. This is datelined Turkmenistan. Leaders from five ex-Soviet Central Asian nations voice concern just these last days, about instability possibly spilling out of Afghanistan, discussed their response to potential security threats. While Russian heavy bombers carried out practice strikes and joint drills near the Afghan border, leaders of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan met in Turkmenistan on the Caspian Sea to talk about regional challenges. I mentioned, Tom, this whole region, former Soviet client states, is now organizing in a fashion I cannot recall since the fall of the Soviet Union. The focus here seems to be what can the Russians do for us? I know that Russia has announced joint exercises with Tajikistan. Do you see at this point in your interpretation of the conduct of the Taliban and its ally, Al-Qaeda, do you see an interest of expanding the conflict and crossing borders, Tom, or is that something that's only theoretical now?
Well, John, it's not just theoretical. I mean, ISIS obviously has recruited a number of Central Asian fighters for its main hub. They've already committed attacks in recent years in Central Asian states. We've covered some of them in the Long War Journal. But what you can see is the offensive that Bill is talking about in the north relies heavily on jihadis from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and other and Uyghur population from Western China. So these ethnic minorities in Afghanistan are playing a big role in the northern offensive the Taliban is carrying out. And I think it stands to reason that some of them are going to want to turn their guns on the Central Asian states probably sooner rather than later. But right now, they are operating as part of these Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups underneath the Taliban's banner. And their central mission is to restore the Islamic Emirates. So they have a lot of fighting to do to try and conquer all of Afghanistan and restore the Taliban's Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. I think after that point, though, that you could probably see an uptick in the threat to the Central Asian states.
The model I have is 1945 to 48. How the Soviets, when they overran the German forces, then reorganized themselves to occupy the capitals of Eastern Europe, but pushed on as far as they could. Paris was at risk for some time because of the uprising of sympathizers with the communist state. Greece was greatly at risk until Truman stepped in. So I'm using that as a model. Bill, do you see any indication that volunteers are flowing to the Taliban from these surrounding states or coming in the way they did for ISIS from Europe? Any sign of that, Bill?
Yes, we are seeing a sign of that, particularly from Pakistan. All indications are that thousands of fighters from Pakistan are flowing into Afghanistan to fight with the Taliban. We have to remember that groups like the Haqqani Network, which is a part of the Taliban. Remember, the Taliban's deputy leader is also the head of the Haqqani network. The Haqqanis are not just based in Afghanistan. They're based in Pakistan. But this should be no surprise. Even during the U.S. invasion, you had tens of thousands of Pakistani fighters there. You know, the call was put up in the madrasas to go and wage jihad inside of Afghanistan. And this is what's happening. So, they smell victory. They're, without a doubt, the recruiting at the madrasas and there's actual Taliban recruiting centers all throughout of Pakistan. And they're no doubt putting out the call. Everyone loves a winner. In the case of Pakistan, the jihadis hate the Americans and they hate the Afghan government. So this is sort of a win-win for the Afghan Taliban. It's an easy sell to get Pakistani jihadists of all stripes, not just the terror groups, which we know are supporting the Afghan Taliban, like the Jaish Mohammed and Lashkar-e-Taiba. We know that fighters from those groups are flowing into Pakistan, but we're just talking like radicalized individuals that are attending mosques. They're also flowing into
Bill Rajo, Tom Jostin, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. What about Al-Qaeda? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rajo and Tom Jostin of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal, a detailed chronicle of these last decades in Afghanistan for the U.S. and ISAF forces, and now a detailed chronicle as those military and support forces leave the country and the Taliban on the march, not only in Afghanistan, but the threat is to the whole region. However, the larger question is transnational threat. In other words, what's in it for Europe? What's in it for the U.S. when Taliban take control of a country and it reverts to its medieval nature from the late 20th century? The question is Al-Qaeda and its kindred of Cain, ISIS. Tom, I start with you because this is a Guardian report in these last days from London. Afghanistan, it reads, could once again become a base for international terrorism, according to a former senior UK military commander who has described the withdrawal of Western troops as a strategic mistake. General Sir Richard Barons warned that attacks in Europe could be the outcome of groups reestablishing themselves in the country. The quote to BBC Radio 4, The World This Weekend. I don't believe it's in our own interest in making that decision to leave. We've not only, I think, sold the future of Afghanistan into a very difficult place, we've also sent a really unfortunate message to the West's allies in the Gulf and Africa and Asia. He went on to say that he's most concerned of Afghanistan once again establishing itself as a base to launch attacks overseas. At this point, Tom, is there any change of the status of Al-Qaeda and its relationship with the Taliban? I remind everybody that the Taliban for some time has been denying that it has any links to Al-Qaeda. Any change in the presentation, Tom? Any boasting that you can see anywhere?
No, I mean, the Taliban continues to lie about Al-Qaeda. You know, one of their spokesmen actually recently claimed to a Jordanian journalist that Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's the head of Al-Qaeda, doesn't even have a bayah or an oath of allegiance to the Taliban's emir. And that's flat false. I mean, it's obvious that he does. This is a very important, religiously binding oath of allegiance. It's a blood oath that the head of Al-Qaeda has maintained to the head of the Taliban since before 9/11. And they maintain that to this day. And that blood oath is of utmost importance to Al-Qaeda because it's where they draw the religious legitimacy for their global jihad. And the Taliban has done nothing to restrain Al-Qaeda or break with Al-Qaeda in any way. Al-Qaeda right now has been for years, as we've reported in Long War Journal, deeply enmeshed in the Taliban insurgency. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda are blood brothers. They're fighting to retake the country from the Afghan government now. They fought together against the Americans and NATO forces for so many years. And there's no indication the Taliban is going to do anything to break with Al-Qaeda. I would say that the Al-Qaeda threat obviously has evolved greatly since 9/11. You know, on 9/11, for example, all 19 hijackers were trained in Afghanistan. That was the central headquarters for that plot, contrary to what some Taliban apologists claim. Afghanistan was central to Al-Qaeda's planning infrastructure and training infrastructure at the time. It's definitely evolved since then. And so now you have threats coming from other countries as well. So it's not the case where Al-Qaeda would need Afghanistan, for example, to train another team coming after the West. However, that could happen in Afghanistan. It's just not as necessary as it was on 9/11.
Bill, there is a report from London, and these things are moving stories, that Joe Biden, the Biden administration, has been warned of ISIS threats forming in Afghanistan. Do you see any indication of ISIS consolidating its authority in any part of Afghanistan that's falling to the Taliban?
The Islamic State really is not the primary threat in Afghanistan, nor is it the secondary threat. But it does, I'm not trying to discount what it is and the threat that it poses. But the real threat comes from the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and its allies. The Taliban controls territory, whereas the Islamic State is operating on a cellular level in groups, in select provinces within Afghanistan. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be concerned about it. But I think the Taliban, once it thinks it's finished off, that the threat of the Afghan government recedes, it's consolidated its control. I think the days of the Islamic State's threat to the Afghans, because remember, the Taliban and the Islamic State, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and its allies on one side are enemies of the Islamic State. The Islamic State threatens the Taliban's primacy in the jihad in Afghanistan. So I think if the Taliban does ultimately turn on them, as they have in the past, the Islamic State really will be have a minimal presence within Afghanistan. Any Islamic State supporters and followers and fighters would likely migrate to neighboring countries, such as particularly Pakistan, and you might see an increase of their recruiting in the stands as well.
Al-Qaeda and its many fingers throughout the world, and whenever Al-Qaeda or its fingers move, you must pay attention to the larger map. So I come to you, Tom, for your report about an al-Qaeda-linked group, Guardians of Religion, attacking in Damascus, Syria. What is striking here is that al-Qaeda is ready to go up against a regime, the Syrian regime, linked to the Russians, linked to a number of bad actors in the area. Is this in any fashion a demonstration of al-Qaeda's strength, or do you see this as a random act, Tom?
Well, I don't think it's a random act, but it's really we're trying to keep tabs on whether or not this is sort of a harbinger of things to come. Al-Qaeda has suffered a number of setbacks in Syria. There was a time, particularly around 2015, where al-Qaeda looked as ascendant within the insurgency and on the battlefield, and they took over Idlib province and other territory and were really taking the fight to the Assad regime. But since the Russians increased their support for the Assad regime and the Iranians did as well, particularly in 2015 and 2016, the jihadis have been on their back foot, and al-Qaeda has suffered serious ruptures in its chain of command and has numerous problems in terms of its infrastructure in Syria, a lot of which remains murky to this day. The group that carried this attack out in Damascus is known as Huras al-Din. It's the Guardians of Religion organization. It's led by al-Qaeda veterans who were trained in Afghanistan pre-9/11, who helped train Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters to fight the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan prior to 9/11. They've been trying to start new operations against the Assad regime behind enemy lines. What's significant about this bombing in Damascus, if it was a bombing in Damascus, is that it's a very rare event these days. The jihadis have had a very difficult time trying to carry out significant operations there. And in this case, last week, they were able to reportedly kill a number of members of the presidential guard, which works for Assad. So it's a potentially significant attack, but we're trying to see if it leads to more.
Bill, a detail. There are several reports about assassination, the word assassination used, directed against the Afghan Air Force, which is one of the few effective ways of stopping the offensive in capitals, with the apparent withdrawal or at least a bridging of U.S. and other air support from outside. Do you link these assassinations, if that's what they are, of Afghan Air Force pilots as Taliban, as al-Qaeda, as ISIS? Can we tell?
I make no distinction between the Taliban and al-Qaeda and then the various al-Qaeda affiliates, allies, Taliban allies, only between the Taliban, al-Qaeda, and the Islamic State. The assassination of the Air Force officers, and I'm seeing assassinations of commandos and other key personnel. These are the elite units of the Afghan military that are limited in number and that have been effective, even if on the margins, in taking the fight to the Taliban. And the Taliban, these are most certainly Taliban / al-Qaeda operations to reduce the effectiveness, particularly the Air Force. There's only a limited number of trained pilots, as well as a limited number of airframes that the Afghan Air Force can put in the air to battle against the Taliban's advance. And every pilot lost, every airframe that is either shot down, crashes, or is taken out of operation because of maintenance or combat damage, it's a victory for the Taliban, and it's a direct an immediate loss of effectiveness for the Afghan Air Force. The pilots, they're one of their major targets for the Taliban. The Taliban wants these guys dead because they're the ones that are really having the most effective at killing Taliban fighters.
Tom, is there an indication now that the contractors who we're told over time have been integral to the functioning of the Afghan Air Force? They have airframes that are exhausted. They need parts. Are the contractors still in country, or are they leaving? And in general, the contractor story, have they left Afghanistan? They were fundamental to the running of the Afghan National Army.
You know, we don't really even know how many contractors were in country before this latest offensive by the Taliban, and we don't really know exactly how many are there now. I mean, some of the public reporting on the Defense Department, some of the oversight shows the Defense Department didn't even know really how many contractors were operating in Afghanistan. So we do have indications that there is a skeleton crew of contractors that are helping the Afghan Air Force and are involved potentially in other operations, but it's really not clear to us.
Bill, I check with you about the embassy. Do we have any indication what's left at the embassy? It's said to be a fortress. Is it manned?
The embassy, it's a great question. We don't know how many embassy personnel are within Fortress Kabul. We do know there's 650 American soldiers and that are protecting the embassy, and several hundred more that are at the airport, because if you got to evacuate the embassy, you got to get them to the airport to fly out. This is one of the major reasons why the loss of Bagram. Can you imagine, John, trying to evacuate thousands of Americans from Kabul as Kabul is under siege and Afghans are going to that airport at the same point? Here's another thing we do know. The State Department issued a general, we'll call it a request or a suggestion. We do know that the U.S. Embassy in Kabul has suggested or issued a statement saying that all Americans who are in Afghanistan should leave the country immediately. I think that's a clear sign of what the U.S. State Department, how they view the security situation in Afghanistan. That is essentially pushing the panic button.
I'm speaking with Bill Raggio and Tom Jostin of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The story so far is that the Taliban is on the march. What about the Afghans and others in Kabul and the other major cities? Can they get out, given that the roads south through Pakistan are not secure, given that the airlift is not yet on the scene, and given the eligibility of people in Afghanistan, what is their eligibility to migrate? When we come back, the U.S. has increased the number of people potentially who could be evacuated if there is the airlift, if there is the time. LongWarJournal.com. That's spelled out, LongWarJournal.com, for illustration, for chronology, for updating constantly. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and Tom Jostin and Bill Raggio of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They are senior fellows. They keep the Long War Journal, which is a chronicle, an examination, an illustration of the collapse of Afghanistan's national army and its police force to the Taliban offensive, Taliban/Al-Qaeda? offensive. Now, what is to be done with the Afghans who are at risk? We hear anecdotes routinely now of massacres, of people threatened. The UK is running right now a headline in London that Afghan people who worked for the British government have been refused migration to the UK. But within these last days, the U.S. made a decision. I read from Reuters in these last days. Thousands more Afghans who may be targets of Taliban violence due to their U.S. affiliations will have the opportunity to resettle as refugees in the United States under a program announced by the State Department a week past. Tom, this requires lots of interpretation. My general understanding is they went from the interpreters, the TERPs, to anyone who worked for the U.S. Army or the U.S. military, to anyone who worked for contractors for the U.S. military, the U.S. government, or the ISAF governments. I hope I've broadened it enough. Do we have a number of how big that is with their families? I remember the original number was between 50 and 70,000. Is it in the 100,000s? Do we know?
The truth is we don't know the precise number. It could easily be over 100,000 or many more. I mean, this has been a 20-year failed war effort, and there have been a lot of different Afghans who have worked for the various iterations of NATO and U.S. forces in countries. So I think, again, you know, looking back at some of the public accountability, some of the oversight reporting that's been done in the Defense Department's operations, they don't really even know how many contractors have operated in Afghanistan. And if you think about it, if they don't know how many contractors have operated there, then they can't know how many people, native Afghans, have worked for the contractors or in what capacity. My sense from some of the reporting from the people I talked to is that the Biden administration has pursued an approach basically where they've sort of set up a tiered system for the people they know were most active or most trustworthy to work with the Americans, and they're doing something to get some thousands of them out. And then there, it gets sort of murky from there on out to try and figure out who basically is, potential to leave the country and come to the U.S. or somewhere else. You know, one of the things about that, John, too, is that, if you think through the long-term implications of it, I mean, obviously a lot of these people, need to be spared the Taliban's onslaught. But what you're also witnessing is a brain drain from Afghanistan, because a lot of these people are talented and represented an alternative future for Afghanistan that didn't involve jihadi rule, the totalitarian Islamic Emirate. They represented an Afghanistan that would be free from that. And by these people leaving Afghanistan, and I'm not blaming them, of course, I think that a lot of them have to leave the country. But by doing so, what you're seeing is a brain drain that basically people who are capable of leading an alternative Afghanistan or contributing at least to an alternative Afghanistan are forced to leave.
Bill, your embed in Mosul, I remember it vividly many years past. One morning you woke up and there was an attack in Mosul and you raced off. You gave us a report and raced off. You were with Afghan forces. You were with Afghan villagers or people who lived in Mosul. If you had to remember all of those people who helped you or were part of that effort, we're looking at dozens, right, Bill? Dozens of people were just around you.
Yeah. So that's what made the Islamic State takeover of Mosul in Iraq in 2014. So depressing to me. I watched in the case of Mosul, Iraqis fight for that city. And, there were a lot of good people. I remember the Chaldean bishop there was kidnapped in the city when I was there, and Iraqi security forces day and night searched for him. The Islamic State Al-Qaeda in Iraq ultimately killed him. But, they heroic efforts to secure the city of Mosul. And, it's going to be no different in Afghanistan where, I only did one embed there with the Canadian Army and had limited contact with the Afghan security forces. I watched them train on a base in Afghanistan. The Canadians didn't think much of them then, and I got to imagine they don't think much of them now, given what we're seeing, how the security situation has degraded significantly since the U.S. withdrawal. And, a lot of individuals are soul searching and wondering about those who did fight heroically, who did help them and their units and to attempt to build a better Afghanistan. I mean, the Afghans bear some blame for this, but so does the West because of our failures in helping the Afghanistans and abandoning them at the moment of their need.
So in your memory, Bill, if Iraq was collapsing as Afghanistan is collapsing, there would be many people who could be at severe risk because they helped you once upon a time. We have 30 seconds. I just wanted to come to that point.
Yes, absolutely, John. There are, as we don't know that exact number, as Tom stated, but there has to be over 100,000 individuals in Afghanistan who have helped many Americans, not just the military, but helping the State Department, helping contractors, helping navigate those difficult waters. And they and their families are a direct threat of the Taliban. We've seen numerous individuals assassinated, families being killed. And this is going to be part of the legacy that the West leaves behind in Afghanistan.
Tom, the last 30 seconds, I have not seen any indication of a consolidation of evacuations forces, either the aircraft to do it or the land or the convoys to do it. Have you seen anything planning like that, Tom? We have about 30 seconds.
Not really. I mean, I think the Americans have been given the clear signal to get out of country. And you can see that a lot of the U.S. and Western personnel are fleeing. I've gotten indications that a lot of Afghans have already fled or are in the process of fleeing, including affluent businessmen and those types who, again, would potentially lead or contribute to an alternative Afghanistan in the future. So I think this is a dire scenario where you're seeing a lot of people are just getting out.
Tom Justin, Bill Raggio, they are senior fellows for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The collapse of Afghanistan underway will require weeks, months, and years of analysis. And the Long War Journal is where to look. That's longwarjournal.com, spelled out. longwarjournals.com for illustration, for analysis, for updating constantly. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.